This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Saturday must be Recovery Radio, and it is. Hi, I'm Steve Martorano. Each Saturday, you'll find us here talking about the disease of addiction and the many ways to recovery and sobriety. Millions of people are living in long-term successful sobriety. So we say every week, while it may not be easy, it's possible. It's possible. That's what we're dedicated to reminding people of. Throughout the year, we have brought you many, many people who are expert in the field of treating the disease of addiction. It's always important to demystify what treatment for this disease is about. And to that end, the sponsors of the program are an invaluable source. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, who foot the bill here, are leaders in the field of treatment. Their people have forgotten more about treating the disease of addiction than many other facilities. So we always rely upon them and their expert people. We rely on them in a special sense because they also have an alumni group, about which we will find out later, because we like to have people come on and, frankly, talk about success stories. These are people that have managed sobriety after some very, very difficult substance abuse problems. So that's what we're going to be talking about again today on Recovery Radio, another voice in recovery, as it were. We rely upon Maggie Hunt for that. Maggie is the corporate executive. Do it again for me, Maggie. I know you don't like to give the title, but go ahead.
Corporate Alumni Officer.
Yes. So she's responsible for this organization, putting it together, and then introducing us to our guests. That's what we're talking about today, and we are real happy to have another member of that alumni group with us. Maggie, do the honors.
Yeah, well, today I have Katie Newman here for you, and Katie is like somebody who's super close to my heart. I have seen her struggle, and like to see her successes today is amazing. I just thought as I was saying that of what the last time that I saw her when she was in treatment, and hopefully I never have to ever see that again because it was not who is sitting here in front of us today.
Well, that's so interesting.
It is my pleasure to introduce Katie to you.
Well, that is some introduction. Katie, thanks for joining us. And I believe every word Maggie just said, but you are the 13th person she's told me she is close to in her life. Because she feels that about everybody.
Well, that's true.
It is true.
That's true.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. We like to begin at the beginning. So tell us who you are.
Okay, great. Well, I'm Katie. I guess I'll start with where I'm from. I grew up in Bel Air, Maryland. I have two parents, a mom and a dad. And they met in college, were pretty young when they met, and also not the most sober at that point in time. So I spent most of my childhood, they split up not too long after I was born. I spent most of my childhood in Bel Air living with my mom and my grandparents, and I also had split custody with my father. And I have a younger sister, a younger half-brother, much younger half-brother. He's 14, and I'm 26 today, so.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and what else? I spent most of my childhood in Maryland, and I ended up having an opportunity to go to a private school in Pennsylvania that my parents really wanted to send me to, so that we landed in York, Pennsylvania. And I spent...
You moved there to go to the school?
Yeah, we moved there to go to the school. My mom always wanted to send us to private school, and we could afford it at that point in time. So it was all off to private school we went. And I spent some years there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you turn out to be what I'm referring to these days as the new face of addiction. And frankly, the reason it's attracted so much attention is that suddenly... It is not some inner city denizen who's a loser anyway and going to go to jail and all that. It's everybody. It's everybody. Now, in spite of the fact you characterize a marriage that didn't hold up and parents who probably drank too much, you would characterize yourself as what? Upper middle class?
Yeah, we were upper middle class. And I mean, I had every opportunity afforded to me. College could have been paid for. I played sports. my mom's a nurse and my dad's a college professor. Like I was not like underprivileged in any way or, you know, things I had a fairly, I mean, yeah, my parents were split up and I can look back and say, oh, you know, things, I didn't necessarily like the way things were, but I had a wonderful childhood with lots of love.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I always say that the stories of substance abuse and recovery are all the same, only they're different. But it is more than passingly interesting that someone from your background is now almost a cliche with regard to where this disease has metastasized to. It is now literally everywhere. It is, people have been fooling themselves forever about the face of addiction, thinking that it only happens to certain kinds of people because they didn't recognize it as a disease. They thought it was a moral failure. You're comfortable with the fact that you had and have a disease, right?
Yeah, I'm very comfortable with it. I mean, I'm pretty open about it today with the people I encounter. I mean, up until recently, I pretty much have just been surrounded by other people in recovery. So, you know, it is pretty normal. But you're right, it is kind of come to be a cliche.
Well, but again, the other thing that we say around here is that cliches are all true. That's,
yeah.
that's how they become cliches.
Yeah.
And if, tragically, it has finally caused people to notice what we're talking about here, then it hasn't been for naught, I guess. I don't know. Tell me, so mom and dad had problems. You say they drank too much or they had problems. What?
That's questionable. I know later on my mom ended up finding the rooms of, you know, Narcotics Anonymous and you know, she got sober in 2008. And my dad, I think, is more what they call the hard drinker. He, you know, he had some issues when he was younger, but he was able to straighten himself out just fine and become very successful and have a really good life. But I mean, when you're 20, 21, I think, you know, who at least the way I always looked at it, when you're that young, who doesn't drink, who doesn't party? But, you know, I'm not sure. They turned out okay.
Well, yeah, some people head down a different path, mm-hmm. Start at the same point and end up someplace else. For you, growing up in this sort of idyllic middle-class situation, tell us about when you sort of discover substances and what were that?
Well, I took my first drink in sixth grade, and, you know, I was just getting drunk off Smirnoff wine coolers, had a couple of those and felt really good. And for me, that was like a magical moment. You know, that was the first time that I felt like I could breathe for the first time.
Well, let's back up a second, mm-hmm. again, because we hear this and if you're not familiar with this disease, if you haven't seen it, that's a hard concept. What do you mean somebody in sixth grade takes a drink of alcohol and has a transcendent moment? It's not just, hey, I got drunk for the first time in sixth grade. Something else went on. What do you mean when you say it changed for you? What was going on before the drink, and how did it change after the drink?
Before the drink, I just always had some kind of unrest inside of me. I just felt empty and alone, and there was no real reason for me to feel that way. I mean, I had, you know, obsessions in my mind before I took a drink, you know, constantly in my head about what other people were thinking about me, trying to plan what I was going to say because I thought I knew what you were going to say and I wanted whatever I was going to say to be right. And my head was just so loud all the time, just constantly going.
Isn't that, Mag, jump in here because you've been in the field. Isn't that, though, typical teenage girl angst? Because you're being judged, you're trying to figure out how to fit in. So how do you know that it's not representative of something larger going on? I mean, it sounds like a typical teenager to me.
Well, that is true, and I think that girls, especially, like, I'm biased because I think that girls especially.
I agree with you. It's easier for guys to fit in than girls, because if guys want to fit in at the same age, all they have to do is act like a jerk.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the universally accepted guy behavior. Act like a jerk.
But I think that it might be a little bit heightened in those who struggle with addiction. Like, it's like you always feel like
you gotta be the biggest
everybody
jerk.
Else is all, you know, everybody else has always like been close. They're better friends and, you know, they have had better opportunities. It's a false pride feeling that you have, like a feeling of like I'm the worst in the room, you know, instead of like the pride being like I'm the best, you know, whatever.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah.
So, Katie, when you say you have this drink the first time and sort of veil is lifted and now you feel more at ease, do you recall that before that you were just having difficulty understanding the rules of the game? Do you know what I mean? Picking up on social clues. And is that where?
Definitely. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of strange. Everything was just so extreme for me as a kid. You know, I had a lot of friends. I wasn't, you know, the odd man out. I, you know, went to the sleepovers, did those types of things. But I just always felt like the odd man out. I mean, looking from the outside, I don't think that anyone would have been thinking, oh, this child has problems, you know, is she okay? She's definitely going to turn out to be, you know, a drug addict and an alcoholic. I felt like I didn't have the guidebook, but it didn't look like that. You know, on the outside, I was okay.
And it must have been made more difficult in that you can't really express that feeling. Because after all, you don't have any reason to feel that way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was never able to express that feeling until I got sober. I had no idea how to explain those things.
And after that first drink, what happened?
Everything changed. I, in my mind, knew that drinking was what I was put on this earth to do. And I wanted to do it as often as possible, as much as possible, until the day I died.
Yeah, is that a real memory or?
That's a real. I remember that so vivid. Just that first feeling of ease and comfort.
Because some people, skeptics, will listen to that and go, she's creating a narrative to fit a circumstance. That really didn't happen. It really did happen to you. You just went, this is it. I found it.
Yeah. And that feeling was just kind of confirmed for me over and over and over again throughout my life.
It kept working, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how old were you when this process began?
Well, I started drinking at 11. And then I got started trying to get sober at 22.
Our guest is Katie Newman. She is now 2+ years sober. So it's possible, and she's sharing with us her story of struggling with substance abuse and her eventual sobriety. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We have another in our periodic series of interviews with alumni, people who are members of a terrific group that Retreat puts together for people who have gone through their program. They are, of course, the sponsors of Recovery Radio, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Katie Newman is our guest in the studio. So, Katie, you had that first drink in sixth grade, and you like it. There are more drinks to follow. Take me through your kind of history of the progression.
No sixth grader drinks every day, as far as I know. So it wasn't, you know, an everyday thing at first. It kind of was just whenever I could get it, you know, over the summer when I'd go to the beach with my cousins, we'd get drunk. Innocent kid stuff, as far as I was concerned. You know, I never really experienced any consequences. Nothing bad ever really happened at first. Then high school comes, weekend warrior type thing. It was a lot more accessible in high school.
But it's still commensurate to what everybody else may be doing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It was as far as I was concerned, exactly what everybody else was doing. It wasn't, I always drank a little bit differently than everybody else.
How so?
Always drank a lot more.
Were you blacking out early?
Yeah.
You were blacking out.
Yeah. Blacking out started in high school, ninth grade.
It's instructive for people to understand what blackout drunk means, because I had to figure this out. I thought it meant completely losing consciousness, and it doesn't have to mean that, right?
No.
It means you're just not aware of what went on during the drinking.
Right. There'd just be a spot in the night where that would be the last thing I'd remember, and I'd wake up, and people would tell me what I did the night before.
Did that scare you, or did you think it was charming? What did you think?
I thought it was more charming than anything else. I was having a good time. It was fun.
Because popular culture has romanticized that notion. I mean, I did what? As though it was the most ordinary thing in the world. Now, people get drunk. Lord knows I've been drunk, but I usually remember how drunk I was. Usually remember I got sick, and I usually remember. Why didn't that scare you when you couldn't remember things?
I turned into a completely different person when I started drinking. And I liked how I felt, and I liked who that person was. I was comfortable with myself. I was comfortable being around people. And nothing – blacking out seemed like such a small consequence to me to give up the way I felt while drinking.
Yeah, the price – it's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. You black out. Were you aware that your friends were not similarly blacking out, or were they?
You know, I actually was not aware of that. There were times later that I would say, you know, oh, I got so drunk, I didn't remember. And they'd be like, oh, I didn't. I remember everything. And that was always really surprising to me. So,
Were you gaining a reputation?
Yeah.
Did you see your reputation changing as a result of that?
Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you do? You couldn't have liked that reputation change, could you?
No, I did not. Did not like it very much. You know, I was a smart kid in high school. I took advanced classes. I was captain of the lacrosse and the field hockey team. I should have had a decent reputation, but I did not. I was that girl that parents did not want their kids hanging out with. I didn't have much respect from other people. I didn't have much respect for myself.
You were aware of all this?
Yeah, very aware.
So let me guess, rather than change your behavior, you changed your friends.
Yep, changed my friends, drank a little more, tried some new substances. Along with that friends change came, you know, like smoking weed. And I just like to surround myself with people that weren't going to, like, give me crap for what I was doing, you know?
Weren't going to judge you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, for those, again, we ask these questions for people who sit around going, how could this happen? Weren't they aware? And they don't understand that this disease seeks a kind of equilibrium so you don't notice you're sick. One of the ways you don't notice you're sick is surrounding you with other sick people.
Right.
Because then it sort of looks normal. Where was this taking you after alcohol, then what?
Well, I, like I had said before, you know, my mom did have a drug problem. I was very strongly against any kind of drug use. You know, drinking was okay. That's legal. But drug use is bad. You definitely shouldn't do it.
Mom was taking pills or stuff?
She was – cocaine was her. Yeah. Right. So, you know, that's really easily slid to the wayside, though, for me. You know, I started smoking weed, and then eventually it would turn to, like, cocaine and pills and other things. So
– did you ever use with your mother?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's another phenomenon that goes on that people, who don't know about this disease, find remarkable. What were the circumstances of you using with your mom?
Well, she wasn't doing so well herself. And, you know, when you're not in your right mind, you make decisions that, you know, aren't the best. So she did allow me to, you know, drink and have parties at the house. And, you know, as a teenager, I'm going to take advantage of that and take advantage of the situation. So...
yes, again, fascinating about this disease in that it took a relationship, which is pretty time-honored, mother and daughter, and reduced it down to a simpler dynamic, two people who abuse drugs. I mean, that's what you were, the two of you.
Yeah, definitely.
And so using with someone like that, regardless of the relationship, didn't matter.
No, it doesn't even – don't even think about it, really.
Going forward, did you get to college or you never even got to?
I did. Yeah. I got to college. I decided to go as far away as I possibly could from York because York was the problem. I just needed new friends. I just needed a fresh start.
So at that point, coming out of high school, you recognize you're out of control and maybe I need a change of it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I knew I was out of control at that point. I just wanted to control my drinking, though. I was not trying to quit. Not at all. And at this point too, it was still really just drinking. I hadn't gotten into too hard drugs yet.
How long after you got to school did that change?
So I ended up going to North Carolina for school. I spent a year and a half there and then dropped out and moved back home. So that's when that changed. So that was 2010, 2011 when I started using drugs.
You dropped out because of the drug use?
Yeah. Well, I was drinking pretty heavily, and I was just really depressed, couldn't get out of bed. I would stay in bed all day just to get up around 6 or 7 to start drinking, and that was just a constant cycle. I didn't go to class. I mean, my GPAs were 0.25. It was bad.
And you were always an overachiever before this in terms of academics and all that.
Yeah, I always did really well prior to that.
Our guest is Katie Newman. Katie is now over 2 years sober. She's taking us through the history of her substance abuse. And when we come back, we're going to pick up that story and also find out her history of treatment. You're listening to Recovery Radio. We have more. Don't go away. We're back on Recovery Radio. Our guest in the studio is a member of the Retreat Alumni Organization. She is with us now two-plus years sober, and she's telling us about that process. Katie Newman in the studio with us. So Katie, you bomb out at school. You get back home. It doesn't slow down your drug use, which at that point now includes hard drugs, cocaine at least, right?
Yes. So it didn't slow down anything at all for me. I moved back in with my dad and stepmother, and I got into a different school. I started going to York College, and that didn't last very long. I did not do well there at all. I did even worse there than I did at the first school. But I had gotten into cocaine, and I had gotten into a little bit of opiates and bath salts at that point in time.
Yeah. Tell me about bath salts, because I thought for the longest time they were actually salts that you bathed in. They're not, are they?
No, they are not. You at one point were able to buy them at gas stations and head shops, and that's why they were called bath salts. Mm-hmm. But no, you don't actually bathe in them. You can't buy them at Walmart or anything like that.
How did you find them? Someone suggest them or?
I was trying to buy ecstasy, and someone sold me the bath salts as Molly, and
In pill form?
It was powder in a pill capsule.
Right.
And it comes in different forms. You can do it in different ways.
Yeah. Hey, were you familiar with ecstasy before you taking these bath salts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When you took the bath salts and compared the high to what you thought you were going to get,
it was so much better.
It was better.
Mm-hmm.
It was better.
Yeah, it was nothing I had ever experienced before. But I was hooked immediately.
But it wasn't like ecstasy, was it?
No.
Or was it?
Mm-mm.
I don't know.
No, not like ecstasy. I would say it was more like methamphetamine. So
where someone in your condition with mm-hmm. the disease of addiction is coming from, this is a fortuitous mistake.
Yes.
Wow, I found something even better.
Mm-hmm.
Probably cheaper.
Much, much cheaper.
Easier to get.
Mm-hmm.
How badly did you abuse bath salts?
Very badly. That really completely changed my life, sent me down into the worst spiral ever,
Why, if they were available and cheap, what was happening that was making it worse for you? The amount you were doing?
The amount I was doing. I was staying up for, one or two days at a time. I was abusing other drugs. I was getting, opiates to come down from that, abusing Xanax, still drinking really heavily on top of this. I mean, all of a sudden, before it was maybe 4 days a week that I was, heavily drinking, maybe sometimes using drugs. But as soon as I started doing bath salts, I needed it every day or else I felt like I was going to die.
Yeah. That's another common theme, unless I'm missing something here, is that along the path of destruction, when you go through these drugs, there's always the drug that starts the real death spiral. Mm-hmm. There's always some point at which now it's in a different realm for you. So for you, it's these bath salts. Here's a question I don't think we've asked anybody, Maggie, and it's worth considering here now. You're a young girl during this process. You're in your early 20s, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What was the effect on your health?
It was really bad. I was so unhealthy. I gained a lot of weight.
You did gain weight.
I did gain a lot of weight. I think that's mostly – I know most people get, underweight, but I was drinking so much and eating so poorly. My mental health was really, really poor.
Right.
My anxiety, depression.
Yeah. So, but in your appearance?
I did not look good. Yeah. Right. My skin was just a strange color. And
and again, people who don't know how this disease operates wonders how could a young girl, attractive young girl, let didn't she look in the mirror and go, I look like hell. I got to stop doing this.
It's funny you say that because I thought I looked great. You know, I really did. I never the weight bothered me, you know, but other than that, I didn't seem to care much. As long as I was intoxicated in some form, everything was good. I didn't care about anything else.
Yeah. The state that you're trying to achieve is this intoxication.
Right.
So you can be someplace else.
Yeah.
Not here. When does that stop working for you? And what are the circumstances about that?
It didn't stop working for a while. I ended up in treatment for the first time, which is kind of weird how I ended up in treatment for the first time. You know, I just had a really bad night. I came to out of a blackout, and literally every friend I had was surrounding me and one of the girls' moms, and they're yelling at me. And I just had this overwhelming thought that, you know, maybe I should go to rehab. And I don't know where that came from because it had never been suggested to me before. It had definitely been suggested to me that I was an alcoholic. My mom had, you know, kind of brought me along to some meetings. But
the thought never formed independently in your head?
No, not at all. Mm-mm.
Okay. And now at this moment, something changed and suddenly.
Yeah.
Did someone say it to you or you say, you maybe I need help?
I don't know if somebody, I mean, I was pretty messed up, so I don't know if somebody said it, but I don't remember anybody saying it, and it just kind of came to me that, you know, it's time.
What's the first thing you did then? Because it's another area we need to talk about. When people have that moment, like, uh-oh, I got to talk to somebody, who'd you call?
I called my mom.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Called my mom. She got me into my first treatment, and I did 28 days there.
Detox, the whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing. Detox from alcohol. It was not fun. That was the first and only time I've ever had to actually detox from alcohol. But that was not
a particularly dangerous medical procedure that has to be handled carefully. What was your attitude about that that period of time?
I really thought that I needed to just go to treatment and get some therapy, and then once I left, I could drink normally.
Yes, again, we've heard that. You clearly recall, going through all this just so you could drink again.
Right.
In other words, you didn't have a problem except that you maybe couldn't handle your alcohol.
Yeah.
And this would help you be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. I'd go back and forth between, you know, really bad things happened when I drank. But not so bad things happened when I was high. So I'd go back and forth between thinking like maybe I could use drugs recreationally or maybe I could just have a couple beers every now and then.
Deal making is a big part of this disease, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just make deals. Yeah. I'll do this if I can do that, or maybe it'll help me do this, but I won't do that.
Yeah.
It's a gigantic game.
Yeah.
So you relapse, right?
Yeah, I relapse a couple days out. And, you know, you talk about finding that drug that, you know, that one that does it for you. I found a couple more of those after that treatment. You know, I met some people in treatment that weren't interested in doing the right thing, just like I wasn't. And you know, I found heroin, I found crack, and things just continued to get worse for the next couple years. I'd go in and out of treatment, in and out of recovery houses, you know, just running through my family's lives. Everybody, it was a mess.
At what point did it change? At what point did that cycle get broken?
Well, I went to retreat for the first time in 2013, and that was the first time I was like, I didn't stay sober after that first time, but I listened when I got here, and I heard like really crucial things. I heard people talk about the disease of alcoholism in a way that I understood and could relate to, which I had never heard before. And I also was told that, you know, I needed to do Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was going to be how I could, you know, have continuous sobriety.
Do you view your relapses as a part of the process? I mean, when you think about it, I mean, not that anyone would want to relapse, but there's a cumulative effect on someone with these failures. Do you look at it that way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think – I wouldn't be sober. I mean, I guess that doesn't make sense, but I wouldn't be sober without them.
I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there's a foundation being built here.
Yeah, I learned a lot, and I had to experience a lot more pain to, like, really learn and really realize that I can't successfully drink or use drugs.
Was that a sort of a flash of light, an absolute insight when you finally arrive at this, oh, I see. I can't do this stuff. Do you remember that moment?
I do. My last drink, I had been sober for 8 months and went out again, went to the bar. I had been going to the bar a lot sober, which is never really a good idea. But I went out with some friends and I drank and I just kept ordering like Long Island iced tea and a shot. And every drink and every shot, I just kept thinking to myself, I'm going to feel better after this one. Things are going to be okay after this one. And I never quite reached that feeling that I had always gotten before. It just stopped working for me. And then I got high after that, and that didn't work either. And then it was like, man, I guess I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I was even, you know, for me, I get really miserable sober if I'm not like doing what I need to be doing and active in a fellowship and things like that. So my only solution was to drink, really.
You know, Mag, jump in here for a second before we take a final break here now. This idea of multiple relapses and going back into treatment, when they result successfully, as they have in Kate's story, we can look at it as a process. And there doesn't seem to be any shortcuts to getting to that point. People either get to the point of clarity and do something about it, or they'll die. And they've got to take whatever comes along to get there, right? I mean, there's no shortcuts.
Yeah, no, there's no shortcuts. And I also think that until the individual runs out of options, like until they know that there's nowhere else to go but to die or get sober, right? Then like that crucial like jumping off point is where you have to get. But if there's options, of course an addict's going to take them. I mean, why wouldn't you? But until you're out of options and you feel that, then that's when the change happens.
Kate Newman, our guest, reached that point 2 years ago when nothing else worked. So maybe I'll give sobriety a try. And it's now two years plus in that effort. And we congratulate her. When we come back, we're going to find out what it's like being sober after having been not so sober for so long a time. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martorano. I just want to remind you the whole thing's brought to you by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. And I give you the phone number again. Peter Shore, the CEO and founder, has often said, give them the number, Steve. Tell them we'll answer questions. Tell them what we can do, or we'll send them in the right direction. And tell them we also hope they never have to use the number. But here it is. It could be a significant factor. Should the disease arrive. 855-859-8808. That's how you reach Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. 855-859-8808. From their alumni group, Maggie Hunt has been with us in the studio. Maggie puts us in touch with people that are in that alumni organization, like today's guest, Katie Newman, who, by the way, right now, you have a successful career as a...
I don't know if I'd say successful career yet, but I do have a full-time job that is really great.
That's great.
I work as a registration specialist, right. in an outpatient lab.
Right.
And okay. I'm in school. Just started school again. So
that sounds like successful to me.
Yeah.
I want to take this one moment before we talk about what sobriety after a couple of years looks like, to visit that moment when this thing takes for you, this idea of moving ahead and not using anymore. Do you remember that moment? How clearly do you remember that?
I don't know if it was one specific moment rather than a collection of different moments. Mm-hmm. You know, after my last relapse, it was only 24 hours, shortest it had ever been for me. And I realized that I just couldn't do it anymore. So I, you know, met with my sponsor, went through the steps again, you know, did all the things that they tell you to do.
This is after a 24-hour relapse.
24-hour relapse, yes.
Did that scare you?
Scared me.
Okay.
Very badly, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want it to be like that. Before that, I had some brief sobriety, and I was happy. I really was. Things were good. My life was going in a positive direction. And I'm not sure exactly when that changed that, you know, led me to the next drink, but I wanted to get back to that place, and I knew what I had to do.
And now you've strung together two years of that.
Yeah.
So this is sounds silly, but why is sobriety better than the other thing?
Well, I'm not suicidal anymore, which is really great. I don't steal from my family. I'm able to go to that full-time job.
But you're now aware that all those things were always true. You know, if you had stopped abusing substances, but now you sort of appreciate that, right?
I do. I appreciate it. I mean, my whole mindset has changed. Everything I care about has changed. I wasn't able to even want those things before.
Right.
I was totally okay with just, you know, dying from this disease, you know, definitely before 26.
When you say you were okay dying of these, in other words, you weren't doing a cost-benefit analysis. You didn't care.
No, I did not care.
As long as you could maintain the high, mm-hmm. whatever happened, happened. Tell us about the alumni group and what it means to your sobriety.
The alumni group's great. Retreat means so much to me. It was there for me multiple times when I needed it. And the employees there are wonderful as well. You know, Maggie is so great. She was one of the first people that I met coming into retreat. And, you know, she's helped me in my recovery a great, great deal. And the alumni group is just so wonderful for everybody to get together and, you know, like-minded people trying to do the same thing to just meet.
Maggie, tell people who might not know how you become a member of this alumni group, and is there an initiation fee, or how's it work?
No, as soon as they leave retreat or if they're in outpatient, they become alumni. We have an app. It's a free app. If you are alumni, you can go to the app, Retreat Alumni and Family. And we also have a Facebook page. It's a closed group. So, if you're in the group, like, nobody else can see what's posted within the group. We have email and newsletters. We also do follow-up calls. I mean, we keep in touch with them, even if they don't necessarily want us to right away. But then they see what we're about and they want to come.
Kate, finally, do you think that there's, in addition to the social aspect of the alumni group, do you think there's a therapeutic benefit?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Apart from, for instance, a 12-step meeting?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's something comforting about coming back to retreat and being here with people that maybe you were in here with or maybe weren't in here with. I know personally, I love the Facebook page. It's so good to see everybody, you know, being successful. And even if, you know, people are struggling, they can post on there. And, it's nice to have that along with, you know, the 12-step meetings. I think that, like, as alcoholics, we need a lot of different avenues of help. So anything that's available is really nice to take.
And it's working. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Continued success with the sobriety. And thanks for joining us here on the program. Maggie, always a pleasure. We'll do it again real soon, I hope.
Oh, for sure.
Maggie Hunt and our guest, Kate Newman. Everybody, thanks for listening. And look for us Saturdays. We're here on Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.